My name is Ryan, and Ron Paul introduced me to Liberty, and it saved my life.
An idea whose time has come cannot be stopped by any army or any government.
The Yummer and Ron Paul podcast starts now.
Welcome to the Honor and Ron Paul podcast. My name is Howard Grattan, and I am here with the Afro-Libertarian. And I am very delighted to speak with him because we've been, I followed him on Twitter for a while. And you can follow him at Afro-Libertarian and the Honor and Ron Paul podcast at Honor and Ron Paul. But with that intro of Ron Paul Saved My Life, I got to get into that to start. Walk me through it.
Well, I mean, it's just a little melodramatic, I guess. He saved my life. You know, it wasn't anything like my life was at, you know, dire risk and I was about to die, but you know, I was, you know, I say about 2008, 2007, I was just pretty aimless. You know, I didn't really have any goals. You know, I had a pretty good job. You know, I had my then fiance and, you know, I was just living life. And politically, I had no really real aim. I just was kind of, you know, just kind of searching for something that means something to me. You know, I just played video games and you know, I watched a lot of TV, listened to music, you know, didn't really do anything. But once I did get introduced into Ron Paul and libertarianism, you know, I began to read. I began to absorb all this information, you know, all this history and stuff like that. And I said he saved my life, but I should have said he changed my life because he just brought more of a, like he just made me step it up a few notches, you know. Yeah, instead of just being kind of a drone that's going through day-to-day life, you know, he made me wake up every day interested in something new. Something's going on today, you know, that has to do with liberty, either my personal liberty or someone else's liberty or something going on in the world. It's almost like, you know, the movie Matrix. You know, and how he looks, you can see the matrix in the little green code going down. It's like I started looking in the world at that green code. I just noticed everything different. And it just, you know, it inspired me to just enjoy life a little more and, you know, and be a little more interested in life and things that goes on and, you know, and just add a few more things to my palette as far as, you know, reading regularly and absorbing new information and, you know, trying to find out, you know, digging into things more than what I would usually do. And I feel like it just made me a better person, you know. I wouldn't say better, but just, you know, a more interesting person and a person that, you know, I could, you know, hold a conversation with someone other than talking about the same old dumb stuff most Americans talk about, you know.
Yeah. That's an excellent point. So when you went through this this transition, because if I'm correct, you started off life as a an Asian female, and then you transitioned over to an African American male. Is that?
No. I was always African American.
I was confused.
You can't miss race me or misgender me. So
I had all these questions about whether it was blackface or not, and oh man, throw me for a loop there, right?
No blackface.
So people, it is a bit of a an idea or a thought out there that the libertarian community doesn't tend to have a whole lot of African Americans, and that's always interested me because, you know, one of my first, you know, intellectual people that I kind of glommed onto was Thomas Sowell, and after Ron Paul, and It kind of seemed to me that, you know, as a white guy, why would I have so much gripes with the government? And then why is it, you know, 90% white? Why isn't it 90% African American? I mean, when you look at the injustices that were done in government to the African American community, What do you think about this kind of disparity between you know, the libertarianism being so white, and yet it just, I don't know where I'm going with this, but I'm sure you get this question a million times.
Of course. You know, I mean, that's why I made the Twitter account Afro-Libertarian. You know, if libertarian was, if there were a bunch of African-American libertarians, I probably wouldn't have made that name, you know?
Right.
Obviously, there was something, individualistic about that, you know? I thought about this a long time, because when I first joined libertarianism, you know, one of the things that I liked about it was because I kind of come from I was always kind of attracted to Black nationalism, mm-hmm. You know, like Malcolm X's of the world and Louis Farrakhan. Not that I wanted to be a Muslim or anything like that. I was fond of the idea of Marcus Garvey, the idea of, you know, okay, Blacks have gone all through all these injustices, you know, victimized by this group and that group and all this pain and suffering and all that stuff. You know, why not make your own area, your own country, your own community, whatever. I was always attracted to that message. It just made more sense to me, instead of just constantly begging and pleading for someone to come and save you or to treat you better and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
So when I started studying libertarianism, I was like, you know, wow, this is a message Black people should grab onto, because it's about self-reliance. You know, it's about building your own, respecting each other's property rights and life and values and all that stuff. And, you know, we could build our thing over there, and it could be as Afrocentric as whatever you want, you know. Mm-hmm. Build it, you know, and leave them alone, and they'll leave you alone. And, you know, we all go about our business. We trade together and all that stuff. I was like, wow, this is a message I should, you know, bring to my friends. And then I bring it to them, and, you know, they'd hear it, and they'd be like, oh, that's interesting. But it seemed like so far-fetched to them, like, no, you know,
we
this is America. We're Americans. You know, we need to make our place here. You know, they need to respect us and this and that. And I'm like, well, okay. And so that just attracted me. And as far as why there aren't many Black libertarians, it's a couple of things. I mean, one is the message. Like, first of all, very few people know much about libertarianism. Like me, I just found out about it in 2007, 2008, you know, because of people like Ron Paul and Peter Schiff. And that just, you know, just that was just the time. That was just that time. You know, with that, the libertarian term was being thrown out there a lot. Now, my curiosity made me look into it. So it's a term that I never even really heard until that time, you know, not that I know of. So it's not being introduced to the Black community whatsoever, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one reason. Another reason is, you know, Black people have been, you know, spoon fed a heavy dose of statism since the beginning, you know, especially, you know, my generation. I'm in my late 30s, but, you know, in most generations before that, but, you know, the civil rights era and all that stuff, that is like, you know, that's like Moses. That's like Moses leading his people. You know, that's like
right.
The Mecca of our religion. You know what I'm saying? Like, that is the thing. And
yeah.
A big part of that civil rights was allowing Blacks to vote, and the government forcing businesses to allow Blacks to patronize their businesses, hotels, restaurants, etc. So there's an automatic tie to Blacks looking at the government as somewhat of a savior. And then you can get more into like great society and the well, you know, Black poverty was at a high level, and the government comes in with welfare and, you know, all that stuff. So there's a natural inclination to look at the government as a savior. But at the same time, you probably won't find any other ethnic or racial group outside of like maybe the what are the people that wear the little hats that live out in the little communities, and they don't talk to anybody, the Amish. You won't find any group outside of the Amish that's like more distrusting of the government. Like,
right.
No Black person trusts the government. None of them. I mean, you can talk to my grandmother, my mother, my dad, anybody. They're like, no, don't trust them. So why do we look at them as something of a savior. But so we kind of look at him just like you would look at your master. You know, we look at him like, you know, we don't love him, but we still need him.
Right.
It's kind of breaking that shackle, that chain, which is like I said, when Ron Paul saved my life, that's what he did. He made me break that shackle where I didn't look at it like that anymore. And so that's just a hard, I mean, that's obviously as libertarians, that's what we're constantly trying to do is get people to break that chain, that shackle, that make them feel like they're needed to be tied to the state and the state can only save them and, you know, get them through life and help them with prosperity. So it's just breaking that chain. But I think once you get through that message, if you know how to deliver the message and, you know, you deliver to like black people, especially ones my age or, you know, under 40, they are definitely willing to listen. You know, they're definitely listening. You know, if they don't, you know, they don't adopt it, they at least kind of respect it as far as it being something that's, you know, self ownership and stuff like that. They, you know, they buy into that. You know what I'm saying? Like,
right.
This was kind of funny. You know, people kind of think because blacks tend to vote Democrat, which is at a very high percentage, you know, 90%, they tend to think blacks are leftist and liberal, but that's not the case. They're not Republicans, but they aren't necessarily. There's plenty of conservative. My mother is a very conservative woman,
right.
But she vote Democrat down the line every time without question. You know, my dad almost is pretty much the same too, and I know plenty of people like that. You know, but it's just, you know, the Democratic Party has. Man, they took hold of that, you know, they took hold of that, you know, that group, you know, they wanted that group and they got them.
Yeah, I guess, you know, if you think about it, you know, if the government is always going to be messing with you and always going to be trying to oppress you, you've kind of taken something back from the government and kind of wrestled that. And so, you know, you almost have to vote Democrat in order to get like the idea that the government wouldn't be messing with you and that you could just live independent is that's not really even possible. This libertarian idea isn't really possible in a lot of people's minds because, you know, the government's going to be there and they're going to be hassling you. So you better get on board with the most active wing that's trying to manipulate and mold the government into what could potentially be the best for you. Is that kind of a way to think about this predominant Democrat vote, but yet conservative?
Yeah, it's pretty much typical. You know, if we just vote in the right people, we'll get what we want. You know, which is typical. It's pretty much typical with everybody. You know, I mean, that's. They all feel like if they just get the right person in there, you know, if we just get Obama in there, everything will be okay. Then if that doesn't, then it's like, oh, well, it's the Republicans' fault, you know, because, you know, blocking everything he's doing or, you know, it's now it's the system, you know, now it's white privilege. It's systematic racism. You know, I don't care how many black mayors and governors and chief of staffs or whatever. President, whatever, it doesn't matter because the system is racist, you know. So now they moved to that. So it's like, well, it was like, well, what do you do next? I guess you burn down the system. So I see that, you know, that might be coming to a head eventually because, you know, what's next, you know?
So it is interesting with kind of the initiation of the welfare state and you know, targeting African Americans to try to get them on the rules of welfare at the very beginning. And I've always just wondered because you also have a lot of similarities in the different groups and cultures. Now I know I'm going to get myself into trouble with all this, but there's such an impact. And I guess this is with my readings of Thomas Sowell, where, you know, once you start to subsidize something, you end up getting more of it. And I was just thinking of this, you know, video that they have on YouTube back from the 70s or 80s with some argument, this debate with Thomas Sowell when he was talking about with this lady who was running the welfare system. And, he was talking about how, if you're subsidizing single families or single parent households, you're going to get more single parent households. And she was like, well, it's only 12%. And, so obviously it's not that big of an impact. And now, when the video was made in early 2000s, it was up to 30. And now it's, I don't even know, 60, 70% of single parent households. And I'm much more of a person who, sees everybody as having mechanistically the same desires and wants when you start looking at a large group. And so it's my impression that, like, if you had taken, you mentioned the the Black nationalism movement and being a very secluded internally trading group that doesn't rely on or try to get respect from anyone else. You just kind of do your thing. And then I think of like Asian Americans and the Japanese, how, they were in internment camps and they were very much a small section, very culturally similar and tended to, Chinese as well, had this little tiny, Chinatown, little tiny sections, and they weren't really sought out by the government to get them on the welfare rolls. And so they didn't have that kind of feedback loop. So I've always been interested in if you had targeted another group or ethnicity with those same type of programs, it's very likely you would have similar outcomes. And I guess you kind of see that with like the Hmong Asians that came from socialist Laos and Vietnam, I believe, and kind of had that, and they still have very poor outcomes relative to their other genetically similar Japanese groups within the United States. And how much of an impact all of these economic incentives have, and how that's just kind of carried forward. It's all just very interesting to me.
Yeah, it is. No, it really is. And, you can look at the Great Society and, the ramping up of the welfare state, and especially in the beginning, it literally targeted women. It incentivized single mothers. Like, it literally did. It mm-hmm. still does today, but it was even more prevalent like in the 70s and 80s. Right. And welfare reform in the 90s kind of changed it a little bit, but still, you're much better off as a single mother than a mother with a husband.
If you got married, you'd lose thousands of dollars a year.
Man, like, it's a huge economic decision, and I know people that make these decisions like, oh, I can't, they won't go out and be like, oh, I can't have a man in my house, but they might have a boyfriend that they won't get married to, but they'll live together and they just don't report it, to the government, and they, when you're on poverty long enough, you learn how to work the system, And so then you start to create this sort of generational poverty of you, your kids, and your kids' kids. They kind of learn how to live within this ecosystem of government subsidies and welfare and Section 8 and all these little ways to get you through where all you need is enough. All you need is a little menial job, maybe 10 bucks an hour, a couple hours a week, just enough. So you could get enough money to live a fairly decent life. You get 500 bucks a month for food stamps. You get 1300 toward a Section 8 voucher to live pretty much wherever you want. You get some help with your daycare, and you got public schools and all that stuff. And a lot of times they'll work side jobs off the books to have extra cash. So it's a pretty, you know, it's a pretty decent life, you know. So, and I know a lot of people that live like that, you know. So it's just created a sort of a generation or subculture that's, I don't even know how you get away from it, you know, because they go, you know, they're going to fight like tooth and nail to keep it, which is what most people do, you know. Humans tend to go for the easiest path, you know, and that's pretty much what's been done. So, but it's tough, you know, when you talk about, you know, the Black experience in America, it's different from everyone else's. And that's not to put down or delegitimize anybody else. You know, the Irish went through a lot to come here. Jewish people went through a lot. You know, I mean, Native Americans, Japanese, Vietnamese, everybody went through something coming here, you know. But the Black people are the only ones that weren't immigrants, you know. Black people are the only ones that were forced to come here and relinquish whatever culture they had and never really got a chance to freely build their own culture. You know, it was built on a plantation, you know, through those times, and never really got to experience true freedom. And, you know, true freedom isn't easy. You know, true freedom is tough. You know, it's survival of the fittest. It's trying to figure out the best ways for you to function. So, you know, 400 years of existence is, you know, slavery, no self-ownership. There's no understanding of freedom of self-ownership and things like that for 400 years. Mm. And then after that, then you have a sort of, you know, this galvanized race of people trying to figure out the right and wrongs of freedom and how to do it. And, you know, it was going fairly well. If you look at all the numbers and, Thomas Sowell talks about it and stuff like that, you know, late 1800s, early 1900s, things were moving in a positive direction, you know. But, but then you still had, you know, Jim Crow, you know, you had all the Black codes and all that stuff. And you had a sort of a couple movements. You had the Black nationalist type movements that kind of wanted to separate and build their own thing, like Marcus Garvey, or the movements that kind of wanted to go back to Africa. You had the left socialist liberal movements like W.E.B. Du Bois, who wanted to, you know, push for social change through the political system and things like that. Then you had the people like Booker T. Washington, and, you know, they come from Frederick Douglass and people like that, who kind of pushed for economic freedom and trying to get Blacks to develop their own businesses and their own, you know, their own institutions to, you know, for them, so to be more economically active and build prosperity within the community before you could worry about racism and what other people think, about your race and stuff like that. Let's build our own thing. And, you know, basically that side lost, you know. Booker T. Washington, you know, in one of his famous speeches, he talked about, you know, just kind of keeping our head down, Black people keeping their head down, learning trades, don't worry about going to these, you know, Harvard institutions and stuff like that, or, you know, getting into politics. Let's start a business, learn how to farm, learn how to, you know, learn mechanics, learn things like that, so you can build wealth, build your family, and then the next generation, build wealth, build family, and then you have a solid foundation to work off, to where you don't even care about what politicians are doing or what laws are being passed, because you control your own community and you control your own path. That's what he pushed, but he was labeled as a sellout and Uncle Tom and all that stuff by W.E.B. Du Bois and that whole movement. And that whole movement was kind of lost, you know, since then, unfortunately. And it's been dominated by the politics, you know, by the politics and the marches and the, you know, that whole social justice push for change, which, and if you look at, you know, you can look at the Asians, you look at, you know, Asian Americans, most of them, they don't have a big political influence. You don't see, you just don't see it, but shoot, from a wealth standpoint, I think they're doing better than white Americans, you know, at some levels anyway. They're doing extremely well, you know. So obviously, you know, obviously that's not the problem, you know. But it's hard getting people to see that, you know, because politics is pretty much everything.
Right. Political influence doesn't equal a good life and success. Yeah, that's interesting. Were you involved in the Ron Paul campaigns at all? Did you get out there and, you know?
No, I mean, I would money bomb some money, but I'd never. Only campaign I was involved in was Peter Schiff's when he ran for Senate. Uh-huh. Yeah, he ran for Senate in Connecticut, and I did some phone banking for him back then. That was like the only time I got involved in something like that, but I never really did the door-to-door thing or anything like that.
So in your immediate friend group and family group, how has all this been received? Are there some people that just like won't talk to you, or are they all just kind of like, oh, you know, he's out there? Have you converted a fair amount of them, or what's your situation?
No, you know, I don't beat them up too much. You know, when I go by my parents' house, you know, they always have like CNN on, and you know, they're worrying about Trump. Oh, Trump is going to do this and do that. And I kind of just kind of throw in my little points here and there where they're usually wrong. Try to let them know about the economy and things like that. My mom's like, ooh, how'd you learn that? Where'd you learn that at? Wow, you know a lot about history. You know, she's always impressed. But I don't know. Like, my parents are in their 70s. I'm not trying to convert them to libertarian or nothing like that. My sisters, you know, they just, you know, they listen, but they just think, oh, that's their little brother, you know. So it's, you know, it hadn't really caused any strife or anything like that with my family. You know, they just think, hey, Ryan, you know, he's just a different kid. That's a different guy. And my friends, they usually like when I talk that stuff, you know, even though my friends aren't political at all, you know, they just like to hear different things sometimes, you know, so it hadn't caused any problems in my life. I know it could if I really like amped it up and really wanted to seek an argument, but that's just not my personality, you know?
Right. Well, that's great. Cause yeah, I mean, you see on some Facebook posts and whatnot about some people that just haven't, is real, like brothers and sisters not wanting to talk to each other because, you know, it really is. And that whole in-group, out-group bias of, oh, I'm so attached to this political party, whether it's Republican or Democrat, that you just can't, you just assume that the other person is evil because that group is evil. It's just,
that's new, right? I don't remember it always being that way. I really don't.
No, it wasn't.
I mean, it is unreal to me. I mean, there are literally families breaking up because I'm so in the brothers of a Trump supporter, or, you know, it was like, what? You know, like, that's just amazing to me. Like, we've got to this point, and it's like, what's the saying? The political is personal. I think it's a feminist from like the 60s or 70s that came up with that phrase. The political is the person, or the person. Yeah, the political is the personal, where that whole political identity is your identity. And you're just seeing this adopted across the board, especially with the youngsters that's coming up through college these days, where their whole identity is their political affiliation and their political beliefs. And that's just a terrible way to live, man. Like, I'm a diehard libertarian, but I got my life too. You know what I'm saying? Like, right. I live regular, normal life. And even though I love libertarian, I read it and all that stuff, I live my regular life too, you know, and I have no problem being friends with, you know, a leftist or someone that's right wing, or I don't know. I mean, I'm always open to hear somebody else's ideas. I argue with them if they want to argue. If they don't want to talk about it, that's fine too. But this day and age to where, you know, I can't even be in your presence unless you think like me. That's just a weird way of thinking. And it just kind of worries me, like, where is this going? You know, because as a society, you know, you can't really function as a society if you're thinking like that, you know. But that's the ideology of these people that's coming up. You know, these new feminists, you know, these Antifa types, these people are, you know, they don't want to debate. They don't want to have a conversation and understand. They don't want that. You know, they want to beat you into submission. And either kick you out so we don't hear you. They want to block you out, or you're going to submit, or you're just going to have to shut up. That's all they want. And that's kind of scary.
Right. And you can really see why some people have, I think, accurately identified this as kind of a religious mindset that, you know, I mean, there's been a breakdown in different cultural identities and religious identities and social groups. I mean, all of these things that everybody used to be involved in. You know, my dad was in the Lions Club and Kiwanis, and it's all just, you know, white-haired guys that are, you know, just about to go. I mean, there isn't really
no community anymore. As a matter of fact, I was talking to my mom just the other day, and we were talking about how there aren't any more neighborhood schools in my hometown, because everyone, you know, you kind of picked up what school you want to go to. It might be across town. If you get into school, you go across town, you go here, you go there. It used to be where you go to the school that was in your neighborhood. Now, I'm no fan of public school and all that stuff. You know, no, of course. But I'm just saying, you know, there was that community where you went to school with the people in your neighborhood. You knew their mom. You knew their dad. You know, you played with them after school. So you knew people, you know, from kindergarten all the way through almost when you're older. You knew them growing up, and there was this sort of community that you built. And that's just becoming less and less. But at the same time, I guess we got social media. And I mean, I don't know how good or bad that is in the long run, you know. But, you know, we are able to build communities that way. But yeah, and there's that whole thing of just having these little social groups that we all, you know, humanity all have always loved to build. There's these little men clubs. And my dad, he was a Mason for a little while. Mm-hmm. He was a part of some other little, like, social and aid and pleasure club back in the day. You know, my mom was a part of the church, and she was a part of this group. And you know, and those things are, you know, existing less and less. You know, you don't see. I went to church this past Sunday, and man, there weren't any young people there, you know. None. And I was just like, wow. Like, when I used to go to church when I was young, it was tons of young people. Now I counted maybe two, you know. And I'm not saying you got to be a religious person and all that stuff, but you're going to fill that hole with something. So, you know, if it's not a church, if it's not a religion, if it's not Catholicism, Christianity, or whatever, you're going to fill it with something. And it seems like politics, statism, you know, identity politics, like that's the religion du jour today, you know?
Right. Yeah, very much so. And, you know, this whole idea of different groups and the need to belong, and the more and more politics is becoming involved in our life, the more and more that then becomes kind of our family, and everyone else outside of that family, you know, by definition is evil, because we're good, so you got to be evil if you're not in our family. It's just kind of interesting, but it makes me think of that old joke. Man, I can't remember the comedian. But, you know, he meets somebody and is like, oh, you know, how are you? Oh, I was just off to church. Oh, you're a Christian? Like, oh, yeah, me too. What kind? And, you know, Methodist. And, oh, you know, what parish? And I don't know what they do, but they go all the way down to the very, very minute detail of exactly what they believe. And at the very end, the person is, you know, a slightly different version of Methodist. And he's like, ah, you heathen. I'll post that on the show notes page. It's
that's basically intersectionality,
right?
You know, that's basically what that is. You know, it's like I'm a Jewish, black, trans, you know, disabled person. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, and the more and more that you kind of get street cred for having those things, the more and more similar to subsidizing welfareism. If you get a psychological subsubsidy for having more and more idiosyncrasies, people are going to be seeking out more and more idiosyncrasies. You know, now you can't just be like, you can't just be like, no, I like women. You're like, oh yeah, I like women, but you know, hey, you know, that maybe I'm fluid enough.
Like, yeah. No, that's a really good point, man. Like, Like, yeah, like, you know, that's the new incentive is to be marginalized and to be a part of this grieved group that needs some kind of special, you know, a special tag on them, you know. Yeah. That's the new incentive. And it's fun. It's so weird as a libertarian. It's so weird because, you know, our whole time is like battling the state. And, you know, I was saying the state actually, you know, the state loves this, but this is being pushed kind of from the ground up almost, you know, from the academic, you know, from the academics is being pushed from the, you know, the social justice warriors or whatever you want to call them. So it's kind of hard to deal with. I know as a libertarian, you know, I was kind of ignorant to this whole culture war and all that stuff. You know, when Trump was coming up, when he was running and all that stuff, I just was so lost. It's like, what the hell is going on here? You know, I mean, you had this alt-right popping up and you had Black Lives Matter and you had, you know, Twitter fights that would go on. And I was like, man, what is, you know, what really is going on here? We're supposed to talk about the state, you know, we're supposed to be, right. You know, there's a war going on. There's you know, we're giving guns to, you know, the CIA is funneling guns to, you know, Al-Qaeda in Syria. Like, what are you guys talking about? I was talking about, you know, white privilege and, you know, microaggressions and all this stuff. And I was like, what in the world is going on? So it's such a different fight today as a libertarian than what I came up with Ron Paul, when it was just about in the Fed, in the wars, you know, bring the troops home, you know, civil liberties, letting people be free and choose their own outcome. Hey, if you want gay marriage, you know, have your gay marriage, you know, localize it, be as localized as possible. You know, let's have, you know, freedom of trade and all that stuff. It was, you know, that was the good old days. And now it's like, it's just a little rough out there, you know?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think with libertarianism, I mean, the smallest minority is the individual. And so I think, you know, since libertarians kind of recognize that, it really does. I was blindsided as well with this kind of reemergence of kind of racial politics and like this regroupification. I don't know what you call it, where like, you know, all these little groups have to have their own little voice. And it's like, you know, groups are much easier to control than individuals. Don't you just see that you're just falling into this trap of, you know, if you're a group and you're begging the government for special privileges, I mean, you're already lost. I mean, you gotta, kind of going back to, you know, Malcolm X type stuff, which I will say, I still leave my bathroom light on whenever I go anywhere. thanks to his autobiography. But you know, that idea that, oh, we're this group and we're going to get specific things, you know, it's completely different mindset than where I'm coming from. And I can see how you and I and people in the libertarian group were just kind of scratching our heads, like, where did this all come from? And I think that, you know, with people already having, you know, Republican and Democrat arguments, and then those are kind of fracturing up, and now Republicans are split into a million pieces, Democrats are split into a million pieces, and now genders are split into a million pieces, and you know, it's just kind of insanity. So I really like how, you know, this philosophy and outlook on life simplifies all that. Like, I'm sure, even though I've never met you, you know, 90%+ of our lives are very similar. That 10% is what everybody really focuses on. Right. You know, in psychology, there's this phrase, you know, in-group differences are much greater than between-group differences, meaning that, you know, if you look at the outliers, sure, you're going to see a lot of things. And I think that's where libertarianism, you can have, you know, a disproportionate representation, because we are political outliers. And so when you see these little tiny outlying groups, there's almost 0% chance that statistically you're going to have an even representation. And it's just, the numbers just aren't going to work like that. But when you look at huge groups like African Americans versus whites, I shouldn't say versus, but, you know, statistically, there's a massive overlap. But if you look at like a white person in the U.S. versus, you know, a white person in Denmark, you are much more likely to be similar to a black person in America than you are that white person in Denmark. It's just the lived experiences are the same, all this stuff. And it's just,
same for a black person, you know, black person from Brooklyn compared to a black person from Nigeria.
Right.
And they have more in common with you than a Nigerian, you know?
Right.
So it's just, you know, it's just how it is. And we share a lot of common culture. We have some different parts of our culture, and that's okay, you know? And, it's just, you know, it's so hard for them to see, especially when you look at, you know, when people talk about anarchy, it's like, you know, we basically live in anarchy, you know, most of the day, you know? And I mean, especially when you look at, you know, racial groups, how they get along. You know, I live in the deep South, and, you know, I never have any problems, you know, like racial problems and stuff like that. Get along with white people, you know, black people, you know, a white person, you know, was serving at a restaurant earlier today at lunch. You know, the white guy that does my lawn, you know, it's like, you know, there is no none of that. But, you know, if we start talking politics, you know, or if we start talking who controls the resources and all that stuff, that's when the animosity starts building up. You know, that's when, you know, we start building our little lines, our little walls around each other and stuff like that. So, you know, if people could just see that, you know, hey, we just, you know, mutually agree to cooperate each other, not violate each other's property rights, and, you know, kind of just move along, you know, everything will just be fine. You know, everything will work out just fine. It won't be perfect. No, you know, there is no perfection. And the government itself, you know, they divide and conquer. It always has been their tactic. You know, it's divide and conquer. You know, they love this whole push of the social justice warriors. They love the intersectionality and all that stuff, because you're just creating more and more special interest groups, you know. So now it's, instead of just, you know, it's instead of gay marriage, now it's the whole LGBT movement. And if you notice, the T of LGBT is starting to kind of form its own little special interest group, you know, the trans community. So Elizabeth Warren's like, she's the trans community, you know. So it's no longer LGBT, it's LGBT and the trans community.
Right.
So, and eventually there'll be something else. All these little groups, you keep breaking them down and you create little special interest groups. And the government loves special interest groups, because you can go to each group and promise them their little thing, and then you get votes, you know. And they, you know, they did the same thing with black people. Democrats did the same thing. And Republicans made the mistake of kind of walking away and, you know, not really trying to court that black vote or that black representation, and the Democrats took it and ran away with it, you know, and now it's probably never gonna get it back, even though I know tons of black people who are fed up with the Democrats. Tons of them. I mean, tons. It's not just an anecdote, you know, it's so many I know, you know, but they just feel like, you know, that's the only game they got in town, you know.
Yeah, and it's the false dichotomy kind of thing. I mean, it's either in one or the other. And it'd be nice if you know, there was a viable third party.
Yeah, I know.
And who knows what's going to happen with the Libertarian Party.
Yeah, who knows? You know, I'm a member, and, you know, I'm trying to support the best I can. But, you know, I think, you know, libertarianism gets its pop when things kind of go bad and people are looking for another voice. So, you know, I guess, you know, if there's like another economic downturn or something, you know, I don't wish it to happen, but, you know, something bad happens, you know, libertarians, people will start looking for, you know, some other voices out in the wind, and maybe we'll get some pop then, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, I became a Libertarian Party member this couple, 3 months ago. Yeah, I hadn't really been all that involved in party. I'm still not involved. I just sent them some money.
Pretty much same here.
and that's all they really want. But, you know, it's kind of like, you know, how can I really have my heart into the idea of using, you know, okay, great. So you got a libertarian president. All right. Well, he still got the government. I mean, it'll probably be better. Who knows? Because, you know, you see all of these. I mean, you're not even voting for any specific policy. You're voting for some person that's going to supposedly represent you. And you have no idea. I mean, I think it was Dave Smith and his Part of the Problem podcast. But he was like, if you had told, as Obama's term was kind of winding up, like, all right, bad news, Democrats. The next president's going to be a Republican. Like, oh, rats. Like, don't worry. He is good friends with the Clintons. He is from New York. He's a New York Republican. And he doesn't really care about any of that socially conservative stuff. And in fact, he's been married multiple different times. And, you know, so very socially liberal kind of guy. And New York Republican. And, you know, would you guys mind if it had a Republican like that? Like, oh, sure. You know, we'll put up with him for a while. Oh, no. It's Trump. They're going crazy. Yeah. He's the worst president ever. Like, all right, I don't know. He hasn't assassinated any American citizens yet. I mean, no. So he's doing a little better than Obama.
I mean, just,
going to end the Afghanistan war, maybe? I don't know.
His standpoint is like, has he really been that different from, I don't know, you know, like Clinton? You know, I mean, Bush, you know, Bush Senior. You know, like, he really hadn't been different at all. You know, I mean, he's less aggressive on war, you know, a little bit. You know, you know, I mean, it's just so crazy. But, you know, I mean, hey, that's politics.
And that's the nice thing about, you know, being libertarian and being kind of a, I mean, we can obviously see, you know, Trump isn't nearly as good as the Republicans say he is. He's not nearly as bad as the Democrats say he is. He's just this kind of doofus guy that, you know, does his Twitter a bunch and is manipulated by the power around him. And I don't know, that's basically what everybody is.
So yeah.
I can't get too excited about him or pissed off about him.
Yeah, and I can't help but enjoy his Twitter and, you know, how he pretty much has made the media look stupid. You know, I just enjoy that. But other than that, you know, I mean, it's, you know, I had hoped he'd be a little better as far as the wars, but he just has no real belief there, you know?
Right.
I think his instincts say, hey, you know, the less we do over there, the better. But he just doesn't even know how, he doesn't know how to start. He doesn't know who to appoint to make that happen. He doesn't know, you know, and unfortunately, you know, even if he does try, you know, obviously they're trying everything they can do to prevent him from doing that.
Right. Yeah. Bad times. All right. Yep. Well, I told you I'd keep you about a half hour. It's already been 50 minutes. So very sorry to keep you so long, but yeah, uh-huh. it's been just great chatting with you. So if you do get that podcast going, the Afro Libertarian, that'd be a lot of fun. We should.
One day I'm gonna get it started. I definitely have to have you on. And I already subscribed to your podcast. And
oh well, thank you.
That's a pretty cool concept. As Ron Paul gets older, I just don't want people to kind of forget him. You know, he was such an awesome. When did you get into libertarianism?
07, 08, that first one. Oh, yeah, I was like kind of a Republican kind of guy before that.
I was just kind of like a laws guy. I was listening to Bill O'Reilly, and I was I was all over the place, man. I was I listened to Alex Jones, I listened to Bill O'Reilly. I was just trying to find something, you know. But yeah, I just don't want people to forget him as he gets older. And you know, I know he's in great health and he's gonna live a while. But you know, he's just so. I mean, the dude is in his 80s now, and still every day putting out a show. You know, where he's beating up on the empire, beating up on the military industrial complex, talking about this fraudulent financial system we have. He doesn't have to do that at all. You know, mm-hmm. He has money. He has his nice house out in Texas on the lake. He has his wife. He could just sit there and ride his bike and just smell the roses and enjoy his life. But he gets up every morning to do this show to wake people up, you know, mm-hmm. And that means more to me than all of these fraudulent politicians that get up every day and, you know, spot off bull crap. He actually gives you things like literally you could put on his show and you will learn something new every day. He's talking about what's actually happening. You know, he's talking about what's going on in Yemen right now, or what's going on in Syria. You could turn on CNN, MSNBC, CNN International, whatever channel, nobody's really telling you what's going on in Syria right now with Turkey and Russia and all that stuff, and how that, you know, this thing could be ramping back up. Nobody's talking about it, but he is, and he really doesn't have to, you know. So mm-hmm. He's really a heroic guy to me, and I'm not one of those guys that kind of look, you know, that kind of what's the word, that kind of
idolize
people, you know. I've just never been that type of person. I'm just like, oh, everybody's human. And it's fine. And he is human. But I think he's earned that respect, you know, from what he's done. I can tell he's genuinely just wants people to, especially young people. He cares so much about young people to really adopt the, you know, the beliefs in liberty and freedom and stuff like that. So I just hope, you know, we could kind of keep his name out there, you know, that Ron Paul, you know, and keep those videos flowing. I try to download as many videos on YouTube as possible just to save them. And maybe upload them later in case YouTube tries to, you know, delete him from existence. Mm-hmm. So this is a great podcast idea. I definitely tell people about it and share it on social media as much as I can, because I hope it's successful.
Well, you're going to be episode 16. So honorandronpaul.com/EP16. Cool. And Afro-Libertarian, it has been a delight.
Same here. Same here, Howard. I appreciate it.